You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, episode number 211. Create your own visual style. Let it be unique for yourself and yet identifiable to others. Orson Welles.
Broadcasting from a dark, windowless room in Hollywood, when we really should be working on that next draft, it's the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, showing you the craft and business of screenwriting while teaching you how to make your screenplay bulletproof. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari.
Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. Today's show is also sponsored by screenwriting software Arc Studio. Now, Arc Studio is easy to use, rock solid, and covers the whole flow: structure, writing, rewriting, exchanging notes with partners, and so much more. It's also great for collaboration and writer's rooms. For example, it's been used in the writer's room of Arcane, the hit Netflix show. Now, if you want to check this out for free, all you got to do is go to arcstudiopro.com and sign up. But because you are listening to this episode, you're going to get $30 off all of their paid plans. So check out arcstudiopro.com/bulletproof to see why they are taking Hollywood by storm. That's arcstudiopro.com/bulletproof. Well, guys, today on the show, we have writer-director Aram Rappaport. And Aram's latest film project is The Green Veil, starring John Leguizamo. And he was just on last week, so I decided to bring Aram on to not only talk about that amazing project that is premiering or has premiered at this point at the Tribeca Film Festival, but we had this amazing conversation about the directing craft, about the realities of directing on set, how you deal with actors, how you get money for your projects, the politics of a set. It was truly, truly a fantastic conversation about just the stories from the directing trenches. So if you are a filmmaker looking to direct a project, this is an episode that I think you're really going to want to listen to. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Aram Rappaport. I'd like to welcome to the show Aram Rappaport. How you doing, Aram?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for coming on the show, brother. I appreciate it. We had one of your compadres on last week, a new guy coming up, John Leguizamo.
My arch nemesis. I hope I never speak to him again, but he's semi-talented. So, you know, I put up with him.
You put up with him. Yeah. He gets the financing sometimes. So, you know.
Yeah, sometimes. don't give him a big head. He's going to watch this and think he's, you know, powerful or something.
Exactly. But I appreciate you coming on, man. You've had a heck of an adventure, you know, coming up the ladder as well. You've got some shrapnel as well.
Yeah, of course.
Without question, of course. some indie film shrapnel along the way as well. So first questions, brother, how and why in God's green earth did you want to do this and get into this business?
the business in general. Oh my God. What a good question I've never asked myself. I think
I never did either, by the way.
I mean, right, exactly. It's such a, you're just like, wait a sec, like now existentially I have to think about things. Originally I wanted to act and be an actor. Mm-hmm. And so I grew up in LA. My dad was a writer. And then he ultimately taught screenwriting as well. So when I was growing up and sort of training as an actor and, you know, went to a lot of class and did that, you know, he had always said you should really write for yourself, because that's going to, you know, be a mechanism to help you get things made. And so you know, organically, I sort of moved into writing a little bit. And then I realized, you know, it just feels better to sort of control the narrative from behind the camera. And really, you know, I was so interested, you know, in being on set. I would, you know, I did a couple little things and I would always, you know, what are we shooting now? What's next? And, you know, the director would always be, you know, why don't you just stand over there until it's your turn to, you know, say your lines. But it sort of interested me to be more, you know, mechanically, you know, involved in the process. And so I think organically for me, you know, directing just helped control the narrative. And I think throughout the years, like I've sort of learned that my skill set is really just, you know, helping everybody else who's actually talented, like see the vision, you know, and motivating them to ultimately, you know, put their all into a project. And I think sort of the only place for someone like that is inherently like, you know, not talented, but like can rally the troops would be, you know, that leadership role, you know, to put it mathematically. But that's you know, that's where I ended up. And I you know, I love it. And I think, you know, my trajectory is sort of odd. You know, you started with indie film, you know, did a few films and then sort of transitioned into commercials aggressively and did, you know, for the last 10 years, I've been doing a lot of commercials and founded an agency called The Boathouse, where we're an agency studio hybrid. And so we do, you know, we do a lot of commercials. And that's really, you know, where I've like honed my skills, both on the storytelling side, as well as really like, you know, from a production standpoint. And now this project, The Greenville, is like the first, I mean, outside of Latin History for Morons, but this is really the first sort of like narrative driven thing I've done in quite a while. So it was a really interesting transition back into that.
There is an insanity, isn't there, for us to do what we do? It's because look, at the beginning it's easy. Look, when everything's going well ish, yeah. It's never well all the way. It's never, never all the way.
Never.
Every like the doors all open, the money just flies in. All you have is time and money to make your projects. That doesn't happen. But when you're coming up though, it's so hard. It's and there's so much. No, so many no's against you. The grind is so hard. You don't even, there's no guarantee that anything that you're thinking of doing is going to actually come into life.
That's right. Yeah, of course.
How did you keep going in those early years? Like when you were just grinding out short films and trying to just get your stuff seen and made and just try to get your foot in the door?
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, I never went to college. You know, my mentality has always been sort of like, you know, just get on the horse and pretend you can ride and, you know, see what happens. So, I mean, I admittedly made a lot of mistakes, right? You know, I mean, I would, you know, have always been very good at sort of pitching the vision or selling the vision, scrapping together a little bit of money, raising money, you know, pitching people on this sensational thing that we're going to do. And then really falling on my face in the production element because I just didn't know what I was doing. So I think for me, it's a little bit backwards, right? Like, you know, a lot of people, like, you know, I went to film school, I really honed my craft. And then I had a hard time getting into the business. I was sort of the opposite. I was very bullish in raising money and finding ways to produce things in a scrappy way and then fell completely flat on the execution because that's where I was learning. I'd never done it before. And I was just like, this sensational, I'm going to direct and do a movie and do this and do that. Sort of usurped the craft itself. And I think that, you know, on my personal journey has been like really important, you know, moving away from this, you know, I want to do it because it seems cool to, you know, this is a craft. And like, what am I trying to say with these, you know, with these projects?
So you were flying the plane while you were building the plane while you were flying it.
Absolutely. no question. And I mean, we all are, right? I mean, I'm sure you have stories where you're just like, I have no idea how I'm going to shoot this scene, but like, it might work. It might not work.
It's,
we don't know.
You know, isn't it fascinating, dude? Because so many of us, and you know, and again, I've had the pleasure of talking to some really insane, legendary filmmakers.
Of course.
And I talk to them and I ask them director questions, just questions that only a director, doesn't matter what level you're at. You could be a short film director or you could be a $200 million Oscar winner. It doesn't matter. But that what you just said is so indicative of a director. Like, okay, we're here. Yeah, I don't know how we're going to do this today. Let's go, because everyone thinks of the director as like Hitchcock or like Fincher that like did the shot 50,000 times in previs, and he's just basically just shooting with real people.
Right.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor.
And now back to the show.
Get the shot because he's already shot the whole movie and edited the entire movie in previs over a year.
Right.
And then he's just like executing his vision. There's like no wiggle room. And that's right, basically right. That's the new generation, the 21st century Hitchcock in the way of approaching the project. Right. But so many, most, if any, if not almost all, there's always scenes that just like, oh, well, the sun's not where it needs to be. Oh, totally. we lost the location. So all my storyboards are gone. So you just have to kind of sit there and figure it out. But I wanted to kind of demystify that for people listening, because a lot of young filmmakers think that, oh, you're working with, you know, John, and you're working on these big projects with these big stars and all this kind of stuff. And you have it all figured out. And I know that you walk in with a plan, but the fit hits the shad, bro. You got to roll. And that's what makes a director, is how to adjust and compromise and move through the stuff that's thrown at you all day. Correct?
Totally. And I think it's like, you know, it's crisis leadership, right? Like, you know, it's, you know, everything's going to go wrong, and that's okay. Like, you really have to embrace that. And I think the thing that I've learned, you know, in the beginning, you walk on set and you think, it's really exciting and sort of like, it's a drug to have the power.
Yes.
And right. I mean, you walk on and you think, everybody's asking me things. Everyone's listening to me. I have all the answers. But then as you get very bad reviews on things and people really sort of bring you back down to earth afterwards, you realize you know, this is such a collaborative process that it's okay to bring those trusted sort of pieces together, whether it's a cinematographer, production designer, whatever, and be like, I know what I'm trying to say with this scene. I don't know how we're going to get there. Let's all talk about it. And I think that's the biggest lesson that I've sort of learned over the years is this, you know, if you as a director have leadership and vision, but you can still be humble in execution, you know, you're going to thrive in a different way than if you have to pretend that you know everything, because no one does. I mean, everybody says they had no idea how to. I mean, Spielberg has stories about how the sun was in the wrong spot. And he's like, I don't know. And he's obviously a genius on a different level, where you think, you know, even though that sun was in a different spot, he probably had 8 ideas. And, you know, he ran them by his cinematographer, and one of them was like the thing that they were going to do. But I think at all levels, I mean, especially for young directors, it's like, you know, rely on the people that you're hiring and say, you know, I don't know. This is my vision, though, that I'm steadfast. Then how do we get there? You know, and you're still going to be well respected.
I love that that you said the addictive kind of drug of the power.
Totally.
My God. Look, I'll tell you a story real quick. When I was coming up, I made a short film that got a lot of attention around town and all that kind of stuff. And I had, I was like one of the first to shoot like, airsoft guns. So I was using airsoft guns. It was an action movie and all this kind of stuff. And I was using muzzle flashes and post and stuff like that. So another filmmaker, another crew found out about us, and they're like, hey man, can we rent your guns? And we're like, sure. So I went down to the set, and this is in Florida, like in the middle of South Florida somewhere. Went down one night, and I had a bag full of soft airsoft guns.
Full of weapons.
Oh, no. This is early 2000s. So I'm walking in, and then we go into the trailer where the director is, and the amount of pompous, like arrogance of this guy, he was – three steps short of just having a monocle and a freaking bullhorn. I'm not joking. Like, he was so far gone. So when I brought in, and he didn't know that I was a director or anything. He was just talking to me like I was a PA, which was like even more disrespectful, but I just let him play it out.
Right. Yeah. What are you going to do at that point? It's his set.
Let's go. Whatever, dude. I don't care. You're going to give me some money for these guns for the weekend? Sure.
I'll take the cash.
So he took the shotgun. I shit you not, dude. Took the shotgun. Pulled out a viewfinder. And pointed the shotgun at himself and said, these will do. And I'm like, oh my God. Even then, I was still coming up, but I knew this guy's out of his mind.
Right.
Oddly enough, the movie didn't go anywhere. But it's just the
Do you want to call him out by name?
I wish I did, man. I didn't even give the memory bank a space for his name, the name of the movie, none of it. I don't remember anything other than like a couple of things that happened that night, but I never forgot him. I'm like, okay, so that's an example of what I don't want to be as a director.
Totally.
So So, all right. So when you got your, so you've been making these short films and then you get your first feature off the ground. How did you get that first feature, which is always the toughest one to get off the ground? Who, how did you convince someone to give you cash?
So, you know, I think, so the first thing that I did was this. So I had a friend, Thomas Decker, who's an actor, and he was in, I forgot what, there was a show called The Sarah Connor Chronicles on Fox for a while.
The Terminator stuff.
The Terminator thing, right? Exactly. Yeah. And he played John Connor. And this is like right when that show was coming out.
Oh, yeah. Of course. I love that show. I used to love that show.
Yeah, exactly. It was a great show with Lena Headey. It was like very, you know, it was a very exciting thing. And he had wanted to be a director, and he is a director. He directs a lot of like very cool stuff. And he went out. We had sort of this group of friends, you know, in LA growing up, this sort of creative little think tank. And he said, you know, I'm gonna go make a feature. I'm not going to do a short. I'm just going to make a feature. I have no money. I'm going to direct. I'm just going to get a bunch of my friends and we're just all going to be in it. And he did that thing and he put me in it. And, you know, I think Megan Fox was in it. It's like there's some Brian Austin Green at the time, like some very like cool people all did this thing. Who knows what happened to it, but it was super inspiring to see him, you know, he did that thing. And I was like, oh yeah, wow. Like he just pulled favors and, you know, asked his friends to be in this thing. And it was that, was my impetus for saying, you know, oh yeah, I want to go and pull these same favors and, you know, and see if I can do it also. And so, you know, sort of to a lesser degree, I mean, I didn't have a show like he did, but I, you know, I was able to pull some favors with people and specifically, you know, Leonard Maltin's daughter, Jessie, who's, you know, a great friend who I've known forever, you know, she really like supported it and was like, you know what, I'll do makeup on this thing. And like, you can use my house. And like, well, you know, this is like right out of high school. And she was just so supportive of like the process and really like brought in some cool pieces. And that was like the first thing. That was like how I did a first sort of feature. I brought in a cinematographer that was also sort of coming up and wanted a feature. You know, that's also another like sort of piece of advice is this. Yeah. You know, a lot of people do short films, right? Like, why not just do a really shitty 75-minute short film, and then people want credits and they want to be a part of it. You know, no one needs to be a part of a short film, but everybody needs to be a DP on their first feature. So, like, those are, you know, thinking outside the box in that way, like, is super helpful and leverage. So, I think that was my first real thing where I thought, you know, let me try directing and I'll figure it out. And you know, it totally sucked. And then. There was another thing that sucked and another thing that sucked. But.
Dude, it's like when I did my first feature, I did the exact same thing. Got a bunch of my friends over in LA.
Yeah.
This insane cast together of all these comedians, shot the whole damn thing in like 8 days. I was like, hey, you know what? I'm going to DP this thing myself.
And you have to. You have to.
And I just like, oh, I'll figure it out. And I'm like, if I could get it down the middle, I'll fix it in post because I'm the colorist. So I'll do the, and you just, kind of go for it. And at the end, you're just like, hey, you know, I got it made. It was like, it was just me proving to myself I could finally get a feature made after like so many years of doing commercials and music videos and other things that I've done. I was just like, screw it. And then it just worked out. But yeah, you're absolutely right. And that's a big tip for anyone listening. Shorts, no one cares about. Truly. No one. It could be honestly an Oscar nominated or winning short film. No one cares. But on IMDb, it says feature. It adds a lot more value to people and they'll work for you for free. They'll work for you for a cheap discount just for the shot. It's a great piece of advice.
And it feels like now there's just so many more mechanisms to create something that's feature length or episodic length versus just doing something, because shorts are great. Like, you know, there are some fabulous shorts that are insanely cool.
Oh,
But I don't know enough about that world. But you think like, I feel like, you know, even 10 years ago, you know, there were shorts that would come out of Sundance and be greenlit at a feature at a mini major or something where you would do like a Fox Searchlight, you know, based on shorts. It feels like that just doesn't happen anymore. It was like at a time when it was hard to get a short made, it was like, wow, that's a proof of concept. Now you're kind of like, it's this weird, aggressive, you know, we're at this place in indie film where excited. Yeah, it's exciting. You can get things made. For cheap. It's also equally as hard, but I think it's you have to be so relentless and that's such a good point. Like, you know, if it's a feature, there's like some great talent that just will want to be involved. And that's what happened on The Green Veil. Actually, we had the cinematographer that I shot a lot of commercials with. Luca Fontini. He hadn't done a feature yet, or he hadn't done anything in the narrative space. And ours was a show.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor.
And now back to the show.
But it's still, it was a narrative, and he just thought, I need this right now. Like, I need this. I'm going to kill it. My agents are going to have, you know, this is going to bring me to the next level on the feature side. And so he, you know, and we paid him a lot less than we would pay him on commercials, and, you know, and he did it. And I think that, and that's why, you know, exactly what you just said.
Because he needs it. And I think nowadays the feature is the proof of concept.
Right.
Because anybody can make a short. And when shorts were hard to make, then that was a thing. But now that anyone can make a short at a very high level, now you've got to, like, just keep going. Just keep, like, I was at a festival once. I saw a 45-minute short. I'm like, what's wrong with you?
Yeah, what's just keep going. Keep going. Yes. 20 more minutes.
Come on, dude. Just break 70 minutes, like 68 to 70 minutes, and you officially call yourself a feature.
Totally.
Just keep going, dude.
Totally. And I, you know, what my first thing that we just sort of, I guess, got distribution was this thing called Innocent that, you know, I was kidnapped, true story, in Chicago when I was 18. And I adapted it into this single take thriller that Alexa Vega, the girl from Star Kids. Spy Kids, what was that? Yeah. Star Wars, Spy Kids. She starred in it, and it was this one take thing, and we did it in Chicago, you know, and choreographed it, and I learned how to use Steadicam, and I shot it. And that's something where I'm like, it's going to be a feature. You watch it and you're like, this could have been a short. Like, it could have been 10 minutes. It could have been 15 minutes. It would have been brilliant. It was 80 minutes and we all fell asleep. But, you know, I learned through that process. You know, that's where I was like, you know, I want it to be a feature. And by the way, we had so much support because it was a feature. It was this one take thing, and every, you know, it was
auteur. Oh no, yeah. You built up. Look, it's like when you do some of these indie projects, it's kind of like you're building up the carnival. So you're the carnival barker. So when I did my first big short, I had like nobody, nothing. It was all dude, it's all visual effects. It's going to be this action thing. And I had like these storyboards and I had our concept art, and I made it look like it was the next X-Men, you know, and everyone was like, I just want to see if this guy can even pull this off. And that's how many people jumped on board to work for free. They're like, I just want to see you either fail or make it. Either one's going to be fantastic.
100%. 100%. And it's like you it is like a traveling circus, because you're like, you're on location with people you would never spend time with.
We're carnies, dude.
Totally carnies. And you think like we're like sort of like highfalutin societal, you know, bourgeois carnies, but like it's bullshit. Like, we go out there and we don't shower for a month. You're like eating shitty food. You know, you're like your grandma's catering with bagels that she found in the back of a.
If you're lucky,
you get that. No, it's true. It's true. It's totally true. No, but it's so exciting, because you're like, you know,
so
what?
Much fun.
Like,
it's so much fun, dude.
And every step of the way, you think like the only people that go through that process, you know, the only people that really not if the film's good, who cares? Like, if it's good or not, like, if you can get through the process, like, it's because you believe that your vision was like absolutely unequivocally untold in any other way. And like, that's the thing that gets you, whether it's true or not, who cares? You know, there's reviewers, there's this, there's distributors. But the fact that you can just get through that process means that you had such like resolute power to be able to not give up on that thing. And that's like the most fun to me, is challenging yourself, where you're just like, we shot nights, it's a 20-hour day. Do I try to get one more take when everyone's exhausted because I feel like I need it? Or do we just go home and give up and say, you know, this was good enough, it's probably going to cut, you know? And it's those moments that challenge you on such an emotional level and a physical level, you know, and you think you get through that. And there's such a rush at the end of production where you're just like, we did it. Like, we did that thing. Who knows if it's good, but we did it. You know, we got through
that. And that's like when Kubrick, you know, would say, he's like, hey, you know, we're all here. They built the sets. Let's stay until we get it right.
Totally.
85 takes later, we can move on.
totally. And that's like, I feel like the one thing I've learned in commercials is sort of how to cut and how to, you know, sort of maintain the sanctity of like those performances and like, you know, protect the actors in that process. In a way that, you know, especially for this most recent thing where we shot like 8 episodes and, you know, we shot like 250, 300 pages. So we were shooting 15 to 20 pages a day with a single camera, and it all looks really pretty. I mean,
you did a single on this?
A single camera. Yeah.
Why? So
because this is another thing. So Luca, our DP, really did not want to shoot with two cameras.
Fair enough then.
And he wanted to, you know, and by the way, like I would challenge him on that because I'm like, we're never going to make our days. If you're trying to light a single frame, you know, we need to cover this in the right way. It turned out that he was just so fluid in the way that he lit. And these images look like, I don't know if you've seen any of it, but the images they look like Norman Rockwell paintings.
You read my mind. They look like paintings. He did a fantastic job. The production design and the wardrobe and the way it was all laid out.
It's a gritty world. And you think like, you know, that was one of those things where I just thought, you know, I'd worked with this guy in commercials so long. I know how we were. I'm like, you know, we have a shorthand, you know, if I'm trying to sort of cut in my head and we can maybe make it work with one camera, you know? So
that's the other thing that a lot of filmmakers don't understand too. Is like, let's say you're a young filmmaker and you get your first project out and let's say there's a DP super advanced, has done $10 million, $15, $20 million movies. And he's like, you know what? I'm going to do your $100,000 movie.
Yeah.
Like the story. That is a death sentence because it's a death sentence. Right. I've been there too. Because if they're used to those kind of resources, they don't understand how to make $100,000 worth of resources work. You can go the other way.
Yeah.
But it's really hard to go back. So like, you know, you can't give James Cameron $100,000 to make a movie. Like he's incapable of telling. He actually, I knew somebody who worked with him and he was talking to somebody on a set and the guy said, oh yeah, I just made my feature. He's like, oh great, man. Great. You know what it is? He goes, yeah. I just, you know, I grabbed $100,000 and I meant to make it. And you could see Cameron's face just, the computer started to crack. He couldn't understand. He's like, been so far. He's been so far, so long, James Cameron, that he couldn't grasp the idea of 100. Like, it's just what?
Good. And by the way, we should all be so lucky. Like, I would like would love to not grasp the idea of
to
work around ideas that
like I don't. Like what? I'm like, you've been Jim Scammer for 30 years, so you don't understand these things.
You've been
Ridley Scott for 30 years and you've shot 10,000 commercials and
I was about to mention that because, you know, going, you know, having done commercials for a while now, you know, whether it's like, you know, for Apple or Victoria's Secret or whatever, you know, I mean, those, everyone says they don't have any money, but when it comes to selling product, if a client believes that if there's a piece of creative that's going to help, the money will be there. It's so different, you know, when you go back to doing something on the independent level where you just think, I can't convince anybody that this crazy oneer is
that I need the techno crane for 5 days.
Yeah, exactly. Like we can't do it. So that was also super exciting to me because for me it was like, you know, having. I don't want to say it's a sterile world. It's a very exciting world being doing commercials, but like, you know, you're reporting directly to a purpose, you know, it's
you're selling product, brother. You're selling product.
It's commerce. That's the thing. It's not art. So it was a totally different mindset, which was such a rush to be like back in that space and be like, oh yeah, no, I don't have as much money, but I also can just do it the way I want to do it. I can go do this thing.
And I don't have to spend, you know, 8 hours lighting a bottle.
Exactly. Like, and it's one of those things where, like, you know, it plays into, I feel like, you know, I always try to like double down on like, what's my purpose? Like, why do I want to do this? Why am I, you know, and like at the end of the day, you know, you want people to really connect with what you make. And I feel like that's been a through line for me in terms of, you know, any commercial I do, there's the really good ones that like people are like, wow, that was a good commercial. There's the really crappy ones that still perform well. And you think, oh, I'm glad it worked, but oh, I just wish it would have created me better. And those are the moments that remind me that like, oh yeah, like I want to be a storyteller. Like my number one goal is not just to do a job or facilitate a thing. It's like, you know, I want to be able to tell narratives that like really, you know, really, really hit. And so that's why it's nice. You know, it's fun to fight for, you know, anything to create anything linearly.
I mean, and it's a miracle that ever gets made, period.
No, it's a miracle. I mean, it's a miracle. I mean, it's impossible, but especially in COVID now.
It's even worse. It's even more impossible to get anything made.
It's impossible. And John reminded me of that every day as he was getting rammed up the nostril with a COVID test telling me that he was doing this for me. And, you know, I thought he was going to walk every time he got a.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor.
And now back to the show.
Okay, I said we could move to the, you know, the anal COVID tests if he wanted, but he, you know, he's stuck with the nose. So I don't know.
He's stuck with the nose, you know, but you know, that's John. But I'm just saying Meryl Streep would have done whatever it needed to be. I'm just saying she would have done whatever Daniel Day would have done, whatever it took. I'm just saying,
John. Can you follow up with John on that actually? Because that's a very good point.
I mean, I heard Daniel Day and Denzel, they had no problem with whatever needed to be.
I tell this story a lot just because I like the article exists, but you know, in China, like during the Olympics, I read there was some article that said, you know, China brings back, you know, anal COVID swabs for tourists at the airport, manual anal COVID swabs. And I brought this article to set and showed it to John. God. And I was like, John, this is the new, this is the new norm. So we're swapping out the nose for the, you know, the anus. And then I just walked out and I said, you know, it's not today. I'm like, it's not today. Today, you know, we're still doing the nose, but tomorrow the hospital is going to bring in the guys that do the anal. It's a different crew. And, you know, I just wanted to let you know. And, you know, anyways, great day. I'll see you out there. And then his assistant came running out and he's like, are we doing the anals? Is that a thing? I'm like, no, it's not a fucking thing. What are you talking about? Of course not. Why would we ever do that? That's crazy. I'd rather get COVID. What do you mean? So that's my relationship with John.
Oh my God, that's amazing. Oh, that's the best story. I'm gonna tell that story everywhere.
But it exists. You can Google it. It exists. I'm not just like some.
But your story with John.
That's an exclusive. That's the exclusive.
So are we doing the anal swabs?
I'm like, tell him yes.
You should have you should have kept that going for a little bit.
I should have filmed it the next day and had someone.
Yeah, you should have. No, you should have done a whole Jackass thing, like they came
totally,
in.
Totally.
Like, brought it again, get one of the grips that John didn't see and be the guy doing it. Like
100%. Meanwhile, we're doing this like super deep, dark, you know, 50s drama on oppression. And he's standing there in his like, you know, 50s garb. Like, wait, am I getting anal swabbed? Like what's happening here? You know,
that's amazing. I mean, listen. So, all right. So as directors, when we're on a set, there's always that one day that if it hits the shan, the light's not there, the camera breaks, there's anal swabs on set. Something happens that you feel like the entire world's coming crashing down around you. On Greenville or on any project, what was that day and how did you overcome it as a director?
You know, that's a good question. I mean, I think that obviously, you know, there's different types of people. You know, some people thrive under, you know, that immense pressure. You know, some people don't. I think that, you know, whether I make the right decisions or the wrong decisions, I enjoy that level of pressure. So I think for me, like, you know, I sort of expect those. There's a level of anxiety where I just expect everything to go wrong. So when only two things go wrong, it's like, well, that was a great day. So I think my mindset's a little bit different. But there's always, you know, I mean, I've had instances where actors have, like, you know, disagreed with a note and walked off, and we've had to shoot coverage of his female counterpart by herself. You know, we've had instances where I had an actor fire our first AD because he hated him on something some years ago. And we were sort of left choosing between an actor and the AD. And, you know, I mean, there were just, I feel like there have been some sort of crazy instances where, you know, everything that I've sort of done on like the linear space has been, you know, a passion project. So like when people come to do that, it's because they're passionate about it. So when you challenge that or change the vision or adjust, or it's not what they thought, like there's emotions run really high, you know, and that's exciting, but it's also terrifying because I think when you're, whether it's a DP or a production designer or an actor or a costume designer, if you sort of show up and tell someone, you know, we can't afford that, or we lost the light, we're going to have to shoot it differently. You know, as a director, all you can do is really maintain like this even keel positivity around, even though you know that it's probably a complete fuck up, you're like, no, it's going to work. This is going to work. This is the right thing. You know, let's keep going. And you know, that sort of like resolute need to like keep the troops marching is really important. And I don't know if there's any one specific thing. It feels like every day or every few days.
Every day.
Oh, there's always something that's so, I mean, we've lost, you know, I think the biggest thing has always been, you know, working on this latest thing. I think, you know, this was like a drama that also had, you know, tonally was sci-fi as well as it, you know, there was some levity to how the characters interact. You know, John would call it a play. You know, it was the dialogue was sort of like repetitious, and it you know, it felt lyrical. And so I think a lot of that was worked out on set in rehearsal, and we had no time to rehearse. So those were the things that were the most challenging. We're sort of, you know, we're shooting 18 pages today. If you rehearse that scene one more time, everything was pertinent. You know, we lose another valuable scene at the end of the day where we have to get an insert on the gun. If we don't, yeah. No one knows she has a gun, and that's the tension, you know? So things like that, what I think were the toughest, where it was sort of like, okay, like, you know, what are we going to compromise on that still collectively, if I step back, you know, this world still works. We still need people to believe that this thing works. And I think those are the sort of things that I felt like I've learned over the years, is sort of like when to really compromise and when to vocalize that we need to get it right.
Yeah. And there's the other thing too, man, is like that they don't tell you, especially when you're coming up, man. I don't know if this happened to you or not, but you get, you know, you're normally, I remember when I was the youngest guy on set, I'm sure you do as well.
Yeah. I'm 20 and a half.
So, but when you're the youngest guy or you're just starting out, the crew, most of the time is a little bit more experienced than you. And sometimes the actors are more experienced than you.
Yeah.
And
by the way, often, right? Like, I mean, there's always going to be someone that's more experienced than you. It doesn't matter if you're who you are, really. Like you truly.
To a certain extent, absolutely. Yeah. But this is what they don't teach you at film school, which is who's testing you to see how far they can push you. And that's with actors. And that's also with key crew people as well. I mean, I've had DPs who were interested in their reel and not so much interested in what I was doing. They just wanted to get their shot because they knew that was going to be in the reel, and they didn't really care about working. You know, they took the project because they're like, oh, we're going to be on this location. I'm going to get the techno crane and I'm going to do this and this. Oh, I'm going to fight for this shot because this is going to get this is going to be on my demo reel.
How'd you handle that? So how did you, like, how would you, you know, so psychologically
the first time it happened, I didn't know what the hell to do. And I had to, like, kind of, you know, the very first time it happened, I had two, and I told the story before, but I'll tell it again. My very first time I spent on my demo reel, when I shot my 35 millimeter commercial demo reel.
Wow.
I'm that old. I shot, it cost me about 50 grand back in the day. All right. And I hired a DP team. So problem number one, DP team. Have you worked with a DP team? No, nobody does because it doesn't exist. But with these guys, they had a grip truck. They had access to the film camera. I needed a high speed film camera. We were shooting at 90 frames. You know, I was doing some, like, really fashion commercial stuff that I was doing. You know, I had a model who was a friend of mine, and we were doing this whole, like, sports model thing. And they were mostly industrial guys and sometime commercial guys, and not LA. Sometime commercial guys. This is Florida. Sometime commercial guys. So that means that they didn't have the same experience as a California or New York team. Sorry, anybody living in Florida. I know a lot of good guys down there, but you know what I mean. It was just, they just didn't have the experience that the crews on the other side have a lot of times. So they came in, and I was so terrified that they didn't know what they were going to do with this film stock because we were shooting reversal stock.
Yeah. Oh my God. I can't see that's, I've never shot a film in my life. The anxiety, I can't even.
Oh God. Dude. So shooting on reversal stock, because I wanted to do that whole, like, McG 90s. Blown out.
I bet it looks amazing.
It's fascinating. It's wonderful. I love that. It's still one of my favorite things I ever shot. We shot this whole thing, but I was so terrified because I'm like, this is with reversal stock, you've got a half stop.
Yeah.
Latitude.
Yeah.
You can't jack around.
Yeah.
So I, like, literally printed out an entire packet on how to shoot reversal stock. I was so terrified.
For the DPs.
And gave it to them. Dude, we shot it and we got it in the can, but they took forever to light. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
They both of them are running around with their light meters, like clicking every freaking corner.
Oh my gosh. Oh my God. All over the anxiety.
And then high speed. So then you hear that film cam go.
Oh my God.
And you hear that sound, and all I'm hearing is like $5, $10, $20.
Exactly.
$100, $150. Exactly. It was just flying by. And I'm like, please don't snap. Please don't snap. Please don't snap. Because if it snaps, oh my God, we're done. And I didn't have like rolls and rolls.
Exactly. And how are you even going to get more rolls if you're out? Like that's
it was insane. So those guys, then we did another spot the next day, and they were so bad. They were trying to like muscle their way into what I was doing. And I was looking at what they were doing. I'm like, this is not good. And I just, at the end of the day, I scrapped the entire thing. I burned the negative.
Wow.
I literally burned it. I burned it. And then I rehired a new DP, and I spent another $20,000 and shot the spot that I wanted the way I wanted to do it and got it done right. So, but with that, those days, those guys, I was just like, I was just constant. And I was yelling out, we're at a half stop. We're 1-4. Like I was the one constantly yelling out, I know what we need to be at here. And I was on them, because I was just so insecure. By the way, first day one, the entire grip team walked off within 10 minutes. That's how ridiculous. That's my first day. First day, I'm spending all my money, and the entire grip department walks away in the first 10 minutes because they were so unprofessionals. They didn't know what to do. So I was just like, oh my God. So that's that extreme. But then I've had other TBs who are like older guys who just, for whatever reason, wanted to like wave their, you know what, in my face and just.
Right.
No, I don't think that's the way the shot is going to be. So then that's the point where you as a director have to go, look, man, we're going to have a conversation. Yeah. And it's not, but that's how you get tested. And then actors test you within the first 5 or 10 minutes, and they test you just to make sure that they feel comfortable.
You totally.
And safe. Totally. If they feel safe, they'll give you the world. But if they don't feel safe, that's when the problems start. Well, do you agree?
That's like, that's why we did this project, is because John and I, having worked together, you know, we've shot two things. We shot a movie, we shot the Netflix special, and then, you know, we've done a handful of commercials together that he's starred in, that he's brought me in on to direct, which has been amazing. But there was sort of a level of trust that was there. And the trust wasn't, you know, that's what people sometimes, you know, they hear that and they go, oh, he trusted you to make him the best he can be. It wasn't about that. It wasn't about the final result. It was trust to explore, you know, and this trust. Right. To be able to take risks and own those risks. And that's the thing that, you'll find a lot of actors will either, you know, really don't want to do. They're going to give you what they're going to give you because they don't trust that when you're in the editing room, you're not going to completely fuck it up. Or there's the other ones. There's the actors that just go totally crazy and need you to hone them in linearly, you know, and remind them where we're at in the arc. And if you don't, you're not going to have a project you can piece together. From a story beat perspective. But I think with John, like the thing that I, you know, admire about him so much is that, you know, we sat down and I pitched this thing to him, and, you know, he said, it, you know, it was a character he never played before and he wanted to, I mean, maybe he talked about it already, but, but, you know, to be able to get on set and watch him do something different every take that still was in the world, but they were different decisions, you know, based on different, you know, sort of like organic, justifications, you know, whether it was an action or, you know, linearly, he thought, oh, maybe I should be at a different point in my journey here. Let's try two things. The fact that he was so open to explore that is why this ultimately works and is successful, because we block shot, you know, 300 pages, and he was shooting, you know, 7 dinner scenes back to back from episode 1, episode 8, back to episode 3, episode 7. And, you know, if we didn't have that trust to sort of stumble through it together, I think it would be like a very different project. So I think he's one of those rare guys that you just think like you've done everything in your career. You've been everywhere, worked with everybody, and you're still just trying to be better, like better at everything, you know, and he's doing it. I mean, every step of the way, he bests the last year of his career, you know.
It's interesting that concept of allowing the space to explore.
Yeah.
Is so important to actors. And John spoke about it in the interview that we had, that he's like, let me bump around. Keep me, there's a box.
Yeah.
I might not know where the end of the box is.
Yeah.
but that's your job to bring me back in if I'm going too far off or I leave the box that we're putting in. But let me play within the box and don't just try to throw me down the middle, because that's when you stifle me. If you stifle me, you're not going to get anything out of me.
Totally. And you think that, you know, this is a guy that's like a Tony winning playwright. You know, I mean, this is a guy who has a Smithsonian, like, you can't put him on set and say, you got to do this one thing. I mean, he's
Give him a line reading. See what works.
Well, and he's, he has stories about that from certain movies where he goes, you know, a director was giving me a line reading and it was like the three worst months of my life. I just showed up. I was a robot. It's like, that's just some people like that. I mean, there are actors that want to go to work and just do the one thing and go home. Like, he's just not that guy, you know, and that's what, you know, that's what I love. I mean, that's what I love about working with him. It's the most incredible thing in the world. And like between that and his activism and this sort of like, I mean, he, I don't know if he sleeps 1 hour a day or what, but like, you know, I mean, he just was like put on this earth to make waves in that way. And you can't stop him.
No. And it's really interesting to see, you know, and we won't turn this into a John love fest, because then his head's going to get too big. And you know,
it already is useless trying to.
No, but in all honesty, though, like you look at an actor like him who's done so many different varieties. I mean, Moulin Rouge and Juliet and Casualties of War. And then the list just goes on and on. And just like, you know, when I was preparing for his conversation, I just went back through his IMDb and his filmography. I'm like, Jesus Christ. Like, there was so many movies that you're just like, that's right, Carlito's Way.
Yeah.
That's right. Oh, he was in that too. Oh my God, that's right. He was, and you just go back, and you know, like I brought up Spawn because I'm like, no one ever calls out Spawn, the clown. It's one of the best performances, one of his best performances ever. I'm like, it's insanity. And that he said he didn't know what he had no idea what he was gonna do up until the director yelled action for this entire time. I believe that.
And I mean, we were talking at some point about the voice of the sloth and Ice Age and how he tried a bunch of stuff and also didn't know what he was going to do. And the studio liked what he did or something like that. I might be telling this story wrong, but then eventually, you know, he got behind the mic and did something and it was like, no, that's it. That's the thing, you know? And it's incredible to see that. I mean, I hate him as a person, but he's a talented guy.
I mean, he's a horrible human being, but as an actor,
he's phenomenal to watch, enamoring.
No, but to be as a performer, and this is also, the way it is with directors, there's certain directors who work this way work kind of like on my last film I did, I shot in 4 days at Sundance about filmmakers trying to sell a movie at Sundance. I stole the entire movie. Beautiful. I got there and I just like, let's roll and let's see what happens. And I was like, oh my God, this is like what it feels like to be an actor in many ways. Cause we were all as a collective, creative collective, figuring it out along the way. To the point where when we were on the plane, they're like, oh, so do you have it? I'm like, I don't know.
Yeah, we don't know. Yeah, we'll put it together.
I have no idea if we have a movie. I have no idea if we have a movie. I think we have a movie. It was such a low budget. And it was just kind of like me just experimenting, having fun, that you were just like, oh my God, this feels so, you feel so alive. Totally. As opposed to being on a commercial set where you're working with a client and it that has its own energy and its own thing. But this, you feel like, oh my God.
Dude, there's an immediacy to it. There's such an immediacy to it.
Right. Like the Duplass brothers or Joe Swansburg, who did these kind of like, you know, mumblecore films back in the day, they're just kind of like, here's an outline. Let's all figure it out today.
Yeah, totally.
It's exciting as hell to do that. It's terrifying, but it's so. But it's exciting.
Totally. It's more exciting if it turns out well.
If it didn't work out, it's like,
we went through that. Okay. I don't know if I'll do that again. But
so is there something that you wish you would have told yourself if you had an opportunity to go back at the first beginnings of your career to tell yourself, listen, Adam, this is, you got to watch out for this.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think, you know, there was this, I did a movie some years ago called Syrup with Amber. It was with Amber Heard, Shiloh Fernandez.
Never heard of her.
Kellen Lutz, a few other people. And it was based on a book. And it was, you know, it was probably like sort of the first like bigger thing that I did. It was an indie, you know, but it was.
I saw, I mean, it looks amazing. It looked, and it was, you were like talking to camera. You were talking to camera, so they had a little vibe to it.
Yeah, they talked to cameras, but you know.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
But it was also from a structural perspective, it was problematic. You know, we had to go back and do reshoots, and we had to, that's one thing I've also learned, just as an aside, you know, there's a script that can read really well, but with experience, you learn what's going to play to an audience sometimes that isn't on the page. And I think that's the difference between those really, really good directors that can see, that can read a script, or a writer director who can write something that they know is going to translate. Because that was one instance where we wrote a lot of direct to camera talking at the audience,
educating. Breaking the fourth wall. Yeah, breaking the fourth
wall. We started, you know, testing it, and we realized that like audiences don't want to be talked to. They want to be shown things, you know? And so it read really well because it was this sort of flippant, cheeky dialogue about marketing, and people read through the scripts. Agents loved it. Actors loved it. I mean, it was a beloved script based on a great book. You know, we went and shot the script, and we were excited about it. I was excited about it. And then we watched it, and it was like, wait a sec, we got to go back and rework things because it just doesn't, we're not rooting for these characters in the same way. But I, you know, back to your, wait, what was your question? I don't even remember.
If there's something that you wish you would have told your younger self.
Yeah. So I screened this film for a producer, and she said, you know, it's not there. But trust me when I say it's not going to be your last movie. You're going to be fine. And I was wrecked.
Yeah, you don't want to hear that. Like,
you don't, no, no, you there. Never want to.
You'll work again.
That's literally you're working. No. And that's like, I mean, because I always try to be like, is brutally honest about these things. Like, you know, I've made a lot of shitty, like very, very bad things because that's how I learned to try to make better. And hopefully my work is getting better as we go. Sure. And this is hopefully not the best thing I'll ever do. And hopefully there'll be more that's better. But, you know, I think there are those guys that are those, you know, those filmmakers that just, you know, they pop onto the scene and that's like their first movie is like a hit. You know, that was like definitely not me, you know, and that was the biggest piece of advice I wish I actually took in, was this notion that like every time I did something bad, I thought, well, this is the last, this is the end. It's never, yep. It was never a learning experience. It was always like, this is shameful, you know, I'm shamed. No one will ever talk to me.
And you know what? And you know what? And you know, look, that stopped me from making my first feature for almost 15, 20 years because
exactly,
of that.
Right. There you go. Exactly. Exactly.
Because of that energy of like the, if I got to make a movie, it's got to be Reservoir Dogs.
No,
it's gotta be a mariachi. Doesn't. It's gotta be Paranormal Activity. It's gotta be something that explodes out of it. And that's the mentality. That was the kind of the Kool-Aid that I drank from the 90s coming up, because that's what everything was like. It had to be this huge thing.
And those were those zingy indies where it was like the only indies you heard about were those indies that were just the best movies that had ever come out in those years, like period.
Absolutely. And the directors all went off to have insane careers. So that was what I thought I had to do. I was like, oh, if I'm going to make something, it has to be like, to be Reservoir Dogs. But then you look back and you go, no, nobody else made a Reservoir Dogs. They all made their own things. Kevin made Clerks, Linklater made Slacker, that they all did their thing. Yeah. And they were right time, right place, right product, all that kind of stuff as well. But at a certain point, you just got to just do it. That's when I finally hit 40, I just said, screw it. I'm just going to go make a movie. And from the moment I came up with the idea to the, when we're done with production, it was 2 months.
Well, and that's what happens, right? You get that motivation. You just go and do it. And you have to be sort of like, neurotic about it and blinded by it.
No, I did it so fast. So I couldn't talk myself out of it. Because if you sit six months, 8 months, you're like, oh, well, I need this camera or I need, cast or I need,
right.
I didn't want to give myself. So it was like a experiment on myself to just go, I'm just going to get it done. To prove to myself that I could tell a story and I could sell a movie, and it did all that. It was fascinating. Now we've been dipping around or towing around the Green Veil. Tell me about the Green Veil, and it's really interesting. John talked a bit about it in his interview. I find it fascinating that you guys kind of did an indie series, self-financed indie series. That now you're out in the marketplace trying to sell, which is something that doesn't get done often. It has been done, but not at this level that I know of it.
With
this kind of cast and this kind of production. So tell me about the project.
So we, you know, I knew, having been in commercials for a while, I knew that I wanted to try to get back into like some linear expression, you know, some content that, you know, whether it was serialized content, whether it was a film, whether it was whatever. So we, you know, just because I launched this agency and studio, we sort of had the facilities to launch a television film division as a financier. We've sort of been blessed with our clients and subsidized that film and television production with money that we, you know, made on the agency side. And so this was sort of that first project for me that was like a proof of concept as a quote unquote, like studio that's financing, just to kind of prove that we could do this. So I think for us, it's like, we knew that we wanted to be in TV. We've never done TV before. You know, we could pitch for years and try to figure that out, or we could just go out and do something and sort of stumble through it. That's sort of always been my approach.
Obviously, as we've made many points of in this interview, it's great. It works for you, sir. And it's fine.
If you learn anything, it's don't do it this way. I'm sure there's an easier way. It'll take you less time. But I mean, you know, so I, having worked with John before, John and I were just coming off the Netflix thing that was a lot of fun and, you know, received well. And John, I was reading these articles about alien invasions that happened in the 50s. And it was this very sensationalized period when there was a lot of, you know, repression and oppression from housewives to, you know, Native Americans to immigrants to everybody, really, you know, was very oppressed in a certain way. It was post-World War II. Women were working during World War II and they were, you know, really running things while men were off at war. And then they came back and there was this reckoning, you know, where women were now suddenly housewives again. Men were trying to like recommand control of their families. And, you know, there was this insane eradication of sort of like Native Americans. So anyways, I wanted to put all that stuff together because it felt like if we could sort of sensationalize, a story that sort of is grounded in this sci-fi element where there were these, you know, these sort of like true reported UFO sightings with, the themes of assimilation and oppression in the 50s, it would make for like a really interesting world. Like at that time, I didn't know what it was going to be, but it just felt like it was a really interesting, you know, let's do an anthology on oppression in America with a really interesting tone that feels like it's not just a drama and it's not just preachy, that it's, you know, we've got a hook. So I looped John in and said, you know, can you play this like all American dad who's like Latin, but we don't say that he's Latin. And there's these really hidden, bizarre undertones of his patriotism. And John was like, you know, I've always wanted to play like a self-loathing, self-hating, you know, Latin. I mean, what he calls is, you know, like a Trumpian Trumpian, you know, supporter, you know, Latin Trump supporter or something.
Got it.
And so, you know, he was always fascinated with like the leader of the Proud Boys, who's like this Latin guy. And he's like, what is he doing? Like, how is that real? You know? And so, you know, we crafted this.
Oh, I got to stop. He's like, did you ever see the Dave Chappelle bit where he was the blind Ku Klux Klan?
Yes, and he was completely, oh my God.
So something like that is what you're saying.
It was literally that, you know, and so that's what we, you know, I said, well, you know, why don't you play this all American guy who like, you know, obviously there's some like, you know, deeply rooted like systemic issues there, but you're tasked with, you know, assimilation, like native assimilation at the FBI, and you're an American and a patriot, and let's let you reckon with those issues. And he's like, I've never played that role before. I trust that we can have fun with this and see where it goes. And from a, you know, not a therapeutic standpoint, but like as an actor, it was something that he like, you know, wanted to embrace. And that was the project. So we thought, you know, let's root it in this family with you and sort of like see where this thing goes. And that's the Green Veil. It's a story of Gordon Rogers, who's played by John Leguizamo, and he's tasked with native assimilation on the East Coast, which is something that happened, was rampant,
yeah,
you know, in the U.S. and in Canada, as, you know, evident by the, you know, discovery of these boarding schools and, you know, these mass graves under these boarding schools that we just found in Canada recently. But, you know, John's character is making way for a pipeline, and there's a lot of nefarious things he's doing, and his wife finds out that there was some, you know, he was investigating an alien invasion that may or may not be an alien invasion. And, you know, shit hits the fan from there. And, you know, John's character ultimately is forced to sort of reckon with, you know, who he is and you know, and where he's going, you know, in this world. And that's how we got to 8 episodes of the show.
That's amazing. And then, and you got the Tribeca, did it screen yet or not?
It's it screened on Monday night, and it's we had an online thing on Wednesday, and then we just screened last night, was our second screening.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And how's it? How is it being received?
It was great. I mean, it was received really well. You know, we got a couple really positive reviews, and you know, people seem very into it. And I think, you know, the challenge for us is obviously, you know, educating a marketplace on an independent TV show. And that's something that is, you know, it's you know, we know the sort of indie model of acquisitions and, you know,
it's fun, isn't it? Isn't that fun? Isn't it the fun part?
it's a lesser known, you know, it's a lesser known reality, but I think like, you know, it's something that we feel really passionate about. I don't think we would have gotten this show made had we not, you know, financed it. And developed it with John in a way that just, you know, he wanted to play this role, and that's what we did. And I, you know, he's, I would never want it. That's something I've learned, is that, you know, working with new exciting actors is great, but working with like your best friends that you trust and who trust you is the best thing in the world. It doesn't matter what the project is.
And man, that's because you've gone into war together already, man.
Yeah. You've
been in the shit. You've been,
it's
in
a different level.
Shit.
It's a different level of trust that you just can't, overestimate, you know. It's,
no, absolutely. The DP, I took the Sundance with me. I'd done a couple projects with him, and I'm like, I just knew, shoot. I know it's going to be done, and it's like, I don't have to worry about that, because you just know they got your back. And then when you work with actors again and again, you're like, yep, I know that they're bringing that toolbox with them today. And and they got your back. And when you're going into the war, man, it's like Full Metal Jacket, man. You just, you know, or, you know, you Joker. You know, or
you just want to do better work. Also, when you're working with people, challenge you to be better. You know, that's the thing. Like, you know, I mean, there's something about, I mean, that was always my thing with John, is like, he has always just challenged me to like, you know, let's make it a little bit better. Let's push, give it to someone else for notes. Let's go, you know, and he's always had to work. I mean, he's been vocal, but he's had to work harder than everybody else to get to where he is. And that is, you know, that was something I reckoned with on Latin History for Morons, right? Like, you know, I'm a white Jew from the Valley, directing Latin History for Morons. You know, I mean, that was something that I would have conversations with him about and be like, am I the right guy for this? Are you sure you want me to, you know? And he would always say, you know, yes, you're the right guy, because the vision that you, your vision is what I want within this project. And like, that's allyship. And it's okay to be an ally, and it's okay to still support and try to be the best you can be. And so I feel like our, you know, something about, like you said, going into battle, but with really dissonant views on things, and then challenging those views and sort of coming together with like, you know, a common narrative, is the thing that, you know, I love most and sort of cherish about that relationship.
Well, I mean, I really hope you do well with this. And this
thank
is
you, buddy.
A new I hope this is a new model for a lot of people out there, because look, man, it's a tough slog doing indie films, man. You know, I'm in the trenches every day, talking to people every day about it, from every aspect, from the script all the way to distribution. I know what's going on with that. And this might be another avenue where creatives, I mean, look, all the indie guys from the 90s, most of them have gone into television.
Right. Exactly.
All of the early 2000s, like because that's where the cool stuff, that's why television
it's so cool. Yeah.
So good, because the writing is so good. And it's just, you know,
and to be able to explore a story in like multiple episodes and
take your time and build it up and all that stuff. It's remarkable.
I've never done anything like that. It's incredible. Yeah.
So I'm going to ask you a few questions. I ask all of my guests, sir.
Let's go.
What advice would you give a filmmaker or screenwriter trying to break into the business today?
A filmmaker or screenwriter trying to break into the business. I mean, again,
just do it and see how it works out.
I think you just got to do it and see. I mean, there's like, you know, you just got to do it. I mean, you just got to do it. Like, if you have a vision and a story that no one else has told, you know, that's something worth risking everything for. So go do it.
What did you learn from your biggest failure?
What did I learn from my biggest failure? You know, to just dust it off and get back up and shrug it off and do and keep going. I mean, I think that's always, I mean, this is like such a brutal town, you know? I mean, like, you know, if a movie's bad, an agent won't get you a job anymore. An actor won't work with you, whatever, but it's all bullshit. I mean, who cares?
Like, right. Yeah. Everyone's, you know, when you're hot, when you're not, and it's like next, but then 5 years later, you write something that everyone wants now. And they're like, Adam,
100%.
Adam, like, how you doing?
Ben Affleck, I think when he won his Academy Award, not the first one, but like the second time, like after his like sort of, his resurgence or whatever. I think, you know, he said it best. He's like, you know, this business is about like just not holding grudges, forgiveness, and just, you know, that's just, I mean, it's cyclical.
Don't take it personal.
You know?
Don't take it personal.
You can't take it, but because again, like you're like, as creators, like we're throwing everything into these projects emotionally and no one else is. The agents are not, the executives are not, no one is throwing themselves into these things. Like, so we take everything personally, of course, like we're going to, but at the end of the day, like, you know, you have to just expect the unexpected. If it doesn't work, you know, you get up and you do it again. If you were meant to do it, if it's truly what you have to do to survive, like you're going to do it again.
I tell you, I was watching an interview with Taylor Sheridan this last weekend, and I'm just the biggest Taylor Sheridan fan in the way. He's like so amazing what he's doing. He's working at a level that all of us afraid to be working at what he's doing right now. And he said, you know, I've been in this town for a long time. I've never seen anybody bump their head against the wall or crash their head against the wall for 20 years and then pop.
Yeah.
I was like, wow, that's such a profound comment, man. It really is, because he goes, I've seen 8 years, I've seen 10 years, seen 12 years, but I've never seen 20 years. And that's when I decided I'm always going to be the 11th on the call sheet. I'm never going to be number one on the call sheet. Maybe I should write. And that's what he did. Because he was, you know, and he's working. And when he wrote the pilot, the first thing he ever wrote was the pilot for Mayors of Kingstown. Uh-huh. After he wrote the pilot, he's like, damn it, I wish I would have been doing this 15 years ago.
Yeah. right.
I wasted all that time just trying to make it, hacking it out as an actor. I really wanted to do, this is where I needed to be. So, and he goes, and this is something I think everyone listening to, I think you might agree with this. The town will tell you what you are supposed to be doing to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm.
To a certain extent. It's like, I'm never going to be a leading man. I'm not going to be Tom Cruise. I'm not built to be Tom Cruise. I don't have the talent nor the looks to be Tom Cruise. But if my mind, I was like, I'm going to be the next Tom Cruise. The town's going to tell you, maybe you're not Tom Cruise.
Right.
But you
I think you're
be.
Tom Cruise.
I appreciate that, sir. Thank you.
I do.
But you could be something else that is actually going to make you happier and actually more true to your path. So that you just got to listen, keep the ears open for that kind of stuff. Now, what is the lesson that took you, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film industry or in life?
I don't know if I've learned it yet. What's the lesson that has taken me the longest to learn? You know, to not try to do everything.
Yep.
I think that would probably be the biggest lesson. I think, you know, it's easy for people on the outside to say, you know, well, why don't you, you know, delegate? And it's easy for us on the inside to say, well, we don't have enough money. We don't have enough this. I have to do it. I have to do it. When you have the right support team around you, it is exceptional. Like the things that you can accomplish are exceptional, no matter how much you want to control everything. You know, it's unbelievable. And sometimes, you know, you have to do multiple things. You have to wear multiple hats, and that's fine. But I think, you know, early on, I always felt like I really had to control things.
Well, because no one's going to do it better than you, right?
Right. Or no one knows, or it's proving the narrative that I'm the director, whatever it is, you know, but I think like, as you grow, you learn that the best thing you can do is let everybody else thrive and then just take credit for it.
You know what? The masters have said that so many times. You're like,
that's all you can do.
Just, you know, whoever you're going to get the credit at the end of it, just let it all.
That's what I say. That's what I always say to the crew. I'm like, you can give me, if you want to, you know, overwork to give me all these ideas, I'll still take credit for it. So that's fine. Work harder. Give me the ideas. Let's go. No, I'm just joking. I mean, it is. I mean, you know, to be humble and to be able to say, you know, what do you think? I don't know what this is going to look like. Let's talk about it, is I think the biggest
lesson. Biggest. But also takes you a minute to get to that point.
No, it does. It does. You have to go through that process. I don't know if anyone on their, you know, their very first movie was like, you know, oh yeah, I am going to just ask for everybody's advice.
Because you're like, I'm not the director anymore. And then you get that chip on your shoulder, like, am I the director? I have to prove that I'm the director. I have to have my name as a director. I can be only directed only and written by only. And I have to do everything. Yeah, at the beginning, you have to feel that way. But as you get older and you get more settled into your and more comfortable in your own skin as a director, that's when you just go, best idea wins.
Right, right. And I think also not over directing is also another big thing. Not over controlling. You know, I mean, there's.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
There's actors that you just need to set the camera and just watch them surprise you. And then there's actors that you really have to work with. And then there's actors that are somewhere in between who want a little bit or whatever. But like really recognizing that with actors, with behind the camera talent, with the production design team, with whatever, like there are people that will feel more empowered and do better if you let them, you know? And I think, you know, really understanding how to lead different departments, you know, in unique ways is something that is super, super important. And it's like, you know, I always tell people, like, just ask, like, you know, ask how someone likes to. I mean, I talked to John about the first day ever, you know, how do you want to work? Like, how are you most successful? Like, that's going to be, is it one take? Do you warm up with three and then we get into it on four? Do you want me to stop you in the middle of takes? Do you want me to let you complete even though we know it's wrong? Like, there's so many different avenues for how to lead a set. And I think, you know, very early on, it's like, you know, I'm going to do it this way and this is what I'm going to do. And it's my show and blah, blah, blah. And now it's like, you know, it's, you know, really understanding the mechanisms that help people thrive is just the biggest thing that you can do. You know, as a director. And I think, and I there were multiple times, I think Donald Petrie told me once, he directed like Miss Congeniality and How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. And he said, you know, don't be afraid to ask for help. Like, don't be afraid. And this is after, I think I was going to Syrup in New York. And I said, you know, what do you have? You know, I'm shooting in New York and blah, blah. And he said, you know, you got to ask for help. You know, when you need help, it's going to be more endearing when you say, I don't know how to shoot this scene. Let's talk about it. And people are going to work harder for you than if you just stumble through it and just pretend you know what's going on. And everyone thinks, I don't know if this is right, you know? And that was like a really, you know, a really powerful thing. And then I was shadowing Rodrigo Garcia, who did a bunch of really cool movies. And he was doing this thing with Annette Bening. And I think I was just shadowing him a couple of days. And he said, you know, he just let her work, you know, he let her dictate everything. And he covered the scene in a way that would let her roam around if she wanted to pick up a cup, if she wanted to, you know, he knew, he played to her talent, you know, and that was like such an important lesson also, which, oh yeah, like, you know, if you've got a great actress, like you have to support what they're trying to do.
You can't box them in. You can't like, okay, hit mark A, hit mark B, but if she wants to flow.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That's the thing they don't teach you, man. Like sometimes when you, and especially when you're working with these actors who are at a different level, like John or Annette, and you know, and I've had the opportunity to work with some actors as well that have just, you know, when you have an Oscar nominee on set, you just go, oh, that's how that's done.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You just feel the difference. You just like, oh, okay. So how do you want to work? How do you want to do this? How do you flow? It's a remarkable experience when you get to work with really, really talented people on all levels, on every crew member and actors.
Yeah. And I feel like you learn how to, you know, in film school or whatever, I don't know, I didn't go, but you learn theoretically, you could learn how to technically lay a mark or, you know, mark, you know, and this and that or whatever. But like the reality is you get to set in like, that actor is not going to want to hit that mark and they're going to want to have freedom. They're going to want to do. So then what do you do? Like, what happens then? You know, and I think that's the thing that is, it's so important that you go out and do it, not just like within your community, but like with random actors that you've never worked with before, with a lot of crazy personalities, because that's the thing that's going to get you honing craft.
Now, last question, sir, three of your favorite films of all time.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Big Fish is, I think, my number one favorite movie of all time. There's just something so magical about what Tim Burton was able to do.
I had John on the show, John August on the show.
Oh, did you really?
I talked to him about Big Fish. Dude, it was just such a beautiful, it's one of my favorite Tim Burton movies.
Same. I know. It was just something. I mean, he tapped into something so magical with that film. And the way that he tried, the thing I loved most is the way he tracked that narrative those there were multiple narratives, and by the time you get to the end, it paid off to like I was sobbing, you know, at the end of the movie. I just that's what I always wanted to do my whole life, is just make people cry in that way and like be rooting for something, and you think this is the, you know, beautiful promo. That was number one. Number two, Cider House Rules is a movie that I really love.
Toby, yeah, man.
Toby McGuire. And I just, it just, something was so, you know, so moral. And there were these multiple storylines that just really fit what they were. Because
Michael Caine was in that too, right?
Michael Caine was in that. He played the, and Charlize Theron was in that as the.
A young Charlize.
Yeah, she, and then I, the last movie, Pirates of the Caribbean. I love a spectacle, man. I mean, I just love it. Like, there is just something so powerful about like everyone asks me, you know, oh, what do you want to do? Like, I'll tour this. I'm like, no, I want to direct like Pirates of the Caribbean 8. Like that. That's like, that's where I want to be. That's great. You know,
put it out there. You never know who's listening. You never know who's listening, Aaron. So yeah, if you want to make the pitch now for Pirates of the Caribbean 8,
you know, I've got the pitch. Let's wait a couple years. Let's see what Johnny, you know, where Johnny lands. But
no, you can't do it without Johnny. You can't. I don't care what you do.
You can't do it without. No, but Pirates was just, I mean, Gore Verbinski, he's one of those directors where you just, I mean, this is a guy who's like cutting these scenes in his mind. Well, and he came from commercialism, and he cut, and he's out there and he's shooting, and he only shoots the things that he knows are going to make it. And then he moves on. And you just think this guy is so efficient in the way that he is crafting scenes. And it's incredible. Like, whether you love the movie or hate the movie, it's, you know, it's a popcorn movie, whatever, but it's just, you know, the way that he sort of put that movie together and was able to get Disney over the line with what, you know, Johnny Depp was doing, and, you know, it's tonally, it was just very cool.
And I have to say, and I'm just going to say it out, because what Johnny did, I've never seen an actor basically take an entire franchise on his shoulders.
He
built it. Without Johnny, without Captain Jack Sparrow, it's another movie based on a ride from Disney.
But he
and Gore working together really transcended that to a place where it's made billions and billions of dollars. And he's beloved throughout the world because of this character. And he was able to tap into something. I don't remember another actor who has done that.
And if you think, if you break it down from like, I'm going to go back to marketing, but like a marketing perspective, like from a purely business perspective, like he was playing an inebriated
for a Disney movie about it, right?
Right. Like you imagine that, like, who, if I was an exec, I'd be like, well, he can't do it. Like, there's no way he can do that. Like, it looks like he's popping pills and then they rolled and then he forgot his lines. Like, what? Like, you're watching dailies from that and you're just thinking, how this does not fit into like our cinematic universe. So I just think it was just so, like, how whatever happened there was just the most amazing thing.
Did you ever hear the story about the gold teeth from Johnny?
No.
So when he was doing Jack, this is before anybody knew what he was going to do with Jack. He already had it in his mind. And he's like, I really wanted 5 gold teeth in my mouth for Johnny. And they were like, no, I don't want gold teeth. I'm not sure. So he walked in, and he goes, I need 12 gold teeth. And they're like, oh, we can't give you 12, John. That's too much. He's like, all right, 5. He's like, okay, you can have 5. And that's how he got his 5 gold teeth for Jack Sparrow back in the day.
Well, the 5 gold teeth were offensive. I mean, he shouldn't have had those.
I mean, obviously. I mean,
obviously, come on.
Obviously, it's a very offensive. And no, but you're right. On paper, it makes no sense why that character should work in a movie of that magnitude based on the property and the IP it was. For a company like Disney, like, it doesn't make any sense.
Right. Like, well, and you're like, so you're going to test that with 12-year-olds and their parents, you know, would you let your kid watch, you know, this misogynistic pirate who's drug-induced, stumbling around drunk all the time? Would that be endearing for you? What do you think? Like, no, it would have never. I mean, that's crazy. You know,
I would love to hear the story of how, like, after day one of shoots, when the dailies came back,
it was not good. I mean, I heard that they were freaking out. I'm sure, like, why? Who wouldn't?
But they were. But the ship. But the train left the station already. And Johnny was a star. And they're like, look, we're here. We're shooting it. We're in the Caribbean. We're gonna make this movie. And he just kept going. And Gore was with him. And he was like, no, man,
We're rolling this. We're
going to have the dailies for long enough for them to not have to reshoot or something. Cause you think like that you think that's what a crazy, no, I would have loved to know what, if you interview him, you got to let me know. Let me know
when I get John. When I get Johnny, he's a little busy these days. I think everybody in the world wants to talk to him.
Yeah.
But when I get, hopefully, I'll get Gore on one day. I'd love to talk to Gore about how he made it. But Armin, listen, it's been a pleasure talking to you, brother. It really
has.
Thank you, Alex. I feel like you're a brother from another mother, man. I think we both got the shame.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Similar shrapnel in our skin how we do our things, brother. But listen, man, congratulations. Man, congratulations on the project, on the Green Veil, and I hope it does amazing for you and continued success, brother. I appreciate it. And don't let John push you around, brother. Seriously, just, you know, sometimes, you know, just slap him around. I think
I blocked his number. I blocked his number.
He's impossible. He's impossible.
He's impossible. He made me promise not to tell the anal swab story. I told it because I'm just so bitter about him, you know, right now, because he always wants to work with me. He says, you know, I need to work with you. I hate all these other directors. You know, you're the only one I want to do everything with. And I, dude, John, calm down.
John, you're a little needy. John.
He's needy. He's desperate. You know, I don't know. He's not busy. He's not working. I don't know what it is, but
he just sits at home just waiting for you to call.
That's all he does. No, we were getting press for this thing last week and on Friday, and they're asking him about 7 other projects, and he's opening a musical the same day. And I have like whiplash. I'm like, what do you mean you're doing all
this? He's like, yeah, I'm doing this movie with De Niro. I'm like, of course.
Yeah. I know. Right. Well, that's the other thing. I mean, he was in Greece on Tuesday, flew in. He said, oh, I did this great thing with De Niro. De Niro was amazing. It was this beautiful scene and blah, blah. And I'm like, wait, you were in Greece with De Niro yesterday? Like, what's happening right now? And then he's opening the musical.
That's a different world, brother. That's a different world that you and I get to dip our toes in every once in a while.
No, it's
a different existence of life.
And I hope people see this because he literally did something that he's never done before. And I think that's the thing I'm most proud of, is being able to champion that performance for him.
No, he's amazing. And I hope nothing of the best for you in this project, brother. Thank you again for
coming, Alex.
On the show, man.
Let's do this again, man.
I want to thank Aram so much for not only all of his knowledge bombs he dropped on the tribe today, but for the laughs. I mean, my God, I hadn't laughed so hard in an interview in quite some time. It was a fantastic, fantastic conversation. If you guys get a chance to watch The Green Veil, absolutely watch it. He did a fantastic job with it. And John Leguizamo is absolutely genius in it, without a question. Now, if you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/211. And if you guys want to watch a free screenwriting masterclass taught by Oscar and Emmy winning screenwriters, all you've got to do is head over to indiefilmhustle.com/free. Thank you so much for listening, guys. As always, keep on writing. No matter what. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv.